urban farming has come a long way from the community garden and backyard chicken coop. How far could it go? About up. The vertical farm is the brainchild of microbiologist Dixon Depommier. And Strange Champs wanted to know more.
I want to start by asking you to share your vision for the vertical farm. So
sure.
Imagine that we're standing together on a street corner in a busy city, Seattle maybe, or Chicago, and up ahead we see the world's first vertical farm. What does it look like?
Well, first of all, the building will have to be absolutely, totally transparent. Perhaps it's 5 to 10 stories tall and maybe a half of a city block in footprint. Inside, you'll see people dressed in uniforms. I presume these are going to be the kind of uniforms that you might find electronics workers wearing. It's a clean environment, in other words, and they're tending plants. And these plants are growing hydroponically. And you've got tomatoes and green beans and cucumbers and pumpkins. And you might even have a few floors devoted to things like wheat or barley.
Is it going to be like broccoli on the second floor and legumes on the 10th?
Absolutely. You know, you can just hear the elevator doorman saying, you know, corn, squash.
How many people could a vertical farm like this feed?
Well, that's a good question. It depends on how big you want to build it. I gave an exercise to my class while I was still teaching. I'm now retired, but one of the exercises that I started with was, you got to feed 50,000 people. How big a farm do we need? I took all the constraints off, like expense and where you're going to put it in the city and things like this, just as a think piece. And they came up with a building that was about 30 stories tall, and it occupied one square New York City block, which is a lot. It's a big – it would be the biggest building in the world, basically. But that building, with the crops that have already been identified by NASA as viable crops that you could grow anywhere and you feed astronauts for the rest of their natural lives, so you could feed 50,000 people a year like that with that size building. So about 130 of these buildings, you could feed the entire city of New York.
That's sort of – astonishing.
It is. It actually is.
Now, I can see lots of advantages to this system. For instance, there would be no need to worry about a sudden ice storm at the wrong season or a rainy summer wrecking the crops because it's all indoors and climate controlled.
And you get continuous crop production, too. So let's take a crop that everybody's familiar with, corn. You plant it sometime in May and you harvest it sometime in August and that's it. That's all you get. Indoors, because the conditions are constant and you're doing this hydroponically, you can get a crop of corn every 8 weeks. So if you divide 8 weeks into 52, you can see how many different crops of corn you can have over a year's period, which means, of course, that if you did it that way rather than outdoors, you wouldn't need that cornfield any longer and you could return it to what it used to be before it was a cornfield. That's usually a hardwood forest in most of the East.
But why do this? We have farm fields.
Well, this is very true. I mean, we have farm fields in this country. In fact, we have lots of them. But if you go to other parts of the world, and I would take you on another trip then to India or to China or to Southeast Asia or to Australia or to any of the Scandinavian countries or to the American Southwest, in those places that I've just described, farming is either failing because of some weather conditions that have been affected by climate change, like the monsoons, for instance, or they've never had rain. In the case of Australia, I mean, that poor country catches on fire every summer. So farming indoors makes the most sense in those cases.
This doesn't seem like the ultimate in factory farming, though, to have a gigantic glass skyscraper filled with crops tended by people in lab coats.
Yep, that's exactly what I'm proposing. I'm not against factory farming as long as it's for a good purpose.
Well, continuing with our thought experiment, then imagine that we're well into the age of vertical farming and we're flying in an airplane over the continental U.S.
Right.
We're over Kansas or Missouri or Iowa instead of all those cornfields. What is there?
Well, let's start in New York City. I'd like to take you from there first because if you go from New York to the Mississippi River, if you could have flown in the 1600s, the only thing you would have ever seen is hardwood forest from start to finish. And in fact, somebody once wrote that a squirrel living in Boston in the 1600s and wanting to visit their cousins in St. Louis would never have to leave the ground. They could just jump from tree to tree all the way through. So the return of large tracts of land to forest would suck up a lot of carbon from the atmosphere, and we know that that's absolutely essential if we're going to do something about climate change, regardless of whether the listener thinks that the human species is responsible or partially responsible or not even responsible for climate change. The fact is that with all that CO2 sitting in the atmosphere, and it's a lot more now than it was, it has to go someplace. And the someplace that I would like to see it go is back into the trees where it used to be before we cut them down in favor of farmland.
What about taste? Because, right. I mean, so much of the taste of our food comes from the land, from the soil, the minerals, the varied weather patterns. I mean, anybody who's had a hydroponically grown tomato knows that there's just it's not the same as a tomato grown in dirt on somebody's farm.
I totally agree with you that soil-grown produce has a unique signature. And depending on where you are throughout the country, that signature varies. And it's called terroir. I believe the term for that is terroir. I would ask you to instead consider being isolated in the countryside of Haiti right now, or in Darfur, or in Niger, or in places that are challenged. You just put food on the table. It doesn't matter what it tastes like as long as it's healthy. And then bring up that concept of terroir again. It disappears entirely, of course, and all you're concerned about is the nutritional status of those poor people. I envision vertical farming not to substitute for these wonderful locally grown crops of plants that we eat seasonally, but rather to serve as a mechanism for ensuring that throughout the world, 6.8 billion people, regardless of where they live, can eat and have 1,500 calories of food that's safe and safe to drink water. And the vertical farm will supply that if it's carried out properly.
The vertical farm idea is catching on and has fired a lot of people's imaginations. And I noticed you've got a blurb on the cover of your book from Sting. Is this more than just a dream? Is it actually going to happen?
Well, in fact, I think I can promise you that it's going to happen even if I were to somehow disappear tomorrow. It's out of my control at this point. I can assure you from the email that I get all the time from business people, from investors, from Forbes magazine, for instance, and The Economist, and the countries of the Arab Emirates are extremely interested in making this happen because, A, the expense of this is not the issue. It's whether or not they can actually put their own food on their own table. Right now, about 90% of their food comes from other places, and they're more interested in food security than they are in the expense of the food itself. Producing food locally, indoors, hydroponically, year-long, in places like Qatar and Abu Dhabi and Dubai will revolutionize the way those countries behave in terms of their food supplies. So they're going to do it. I think by next year I should be able to show you one.
Dixon Depommier is a microbiologist and the author of The Vertical Farm.